So my name's Elnor Saita. I'm a designer among various other things. Test. Okay. So, among other things, I'm a designer, and I'm here to talk about designing the future of sex. When Johannes asked me to submit a talk, I kind of thought, well, you know, what do I have to say about sex? You know, what can I contribute to this? And I realized there's actually a lot. Design objects, experiences really affect how we live our lives in ways we really don't even realize. Sex and relationships are just as affected as any other part of our life. As technology changes, those changes are driven by social desires. Social desires prioritize what to fund with technology. They decide what's off limits, where things go. But technological progress and the forms that it takes change society too. There's a feedback loop there. And by changing the forms that technology takes and the design takes, we can end up affecting social change. Social change requires mass disruption. Individual hacking is a wonderful thing, but on its own, it's not going to be sufficient to actually change society. As society changes, the changes accelerate over time. You know, social change 5 years out through technology isn't really that visible. You don't really notice it. It's kind of the background thing. And then 20 years out, after it's piled on and piled on and piled on, it's suddenly unrecognizable, and you're suddenly living in this completely different world. Design fiction as a form of looking forward to the future can change how we interact with the world by opening our eyes and letting us see our context from the outside, letting us see where that path might go. It lets us see what's actually transgressive about our current state and the actions that we can take now. It's going to get pretty weird around here over the next 20 years, over the next 40 years. I think that we are going to see some really accelerating social changes as we, you know, we are in this transitional state of the way people interact with the world in terms of information. And things are changing at a faster pace than we've really seen before. For the rest of this talk, I'm going to explore this territory using design fiction as a lens. We're going to explore a set of questions which I generated when I was writing the talk that are in roughly five categories around intimacy, identity, awareness, control, and economics. I'm not going to read the questions off. I'll just put them up here. The slides will be on later. You can just read them. So for the talk today, we're going to be treading right around kind of the line of possibility and probability. At a certain point, design, and even really thinking about technology, ceases to be very useful. We cease to have any meaningful vision into the future. It's simply kind of beyond an event horizon where we can see. That shorter time period, that immediate future, is kind of where design becomes useful and where design thinking becomes useful, where we can actually say, oh yes, I can understand how that might work. I can create something based on how that might work, even if I can't actualize it right now. Most of the fictions that I'm talking about today are going to be designed objects, designed experiences, designed systems. I'm kind of leaving the area of biotechnology alone, partially because it's changing too fast, and we don't really understand where that's going to go. The event horizon there is very, very short. And as breakthroughs come through, I think we're going to suddenly understand that we have radically different toolkits there, so radically that we can't really say that much about it right now. On the bottom of each slide in the fictions, there will be a timeline to show roughly how far out we're thinking. It's also worth noting that most of the fictions here are focusing not on sex acts themselves in a narrow sense, but more on economic and social relationships around those sex acts, mediating those sex acts, mediating those relationships. It's that larger kind of complicated territory that we're addressing. So, onto the fictions. Fragmented identities that have kind of come about through modern sexuality really, in some ways, complicate social space. They complicate meeting people in a situated manner. You know, you can flag for BDSM or various things like that, but they don't generalize across the larger culture. Things like personal sites end up adding another layer of division socially instead of unifying across those identities, because they all end up being opt-in. So, you know, oh, you're not on that site. I only see this little limited slice of the population. You know, so there's kind of all of these layers of social fragmentation. There are mechanisms of subculture which work to a certain degree, but, you know, the people you meet in the club on the other side of town aren't necessarily the people who live next door to you. How do you find out if the girl next door to you really likes to be choked? Subcultures and sexual diversity can alienate us from our surroundings because they make us assume that by default we are divided from the people near us, that, you know, the people next door aren't like me because I'm some sort of freak and they're probably some other sort of freak. So they make that lack of commonality sort of a default assumption. A lot of people say that privacy is dead. I'm not sure if I agree with them, but assuming privacy is dead, why wait for someone to announce that they're looking? You know, you walk into a grocery store, your phone takes a look around, figures out who all the other phones belong to, and then driftnets through their data shadows online and says, oh, yeah, that person looks interesting. You should go talk to them. And, you know, while you're picking out tomatoes, you know, your phone tells you that, oh, yeah, you should really go talk to that cute woman by the fruit. You know, you should go say hi. The mobile parts of doing this are actually pretty trivial given current technology. We need a little bit more locative awareness on phones, on, you know, whatever appliance we happen to be carrying with us, to say, oh yeah, that person over there, not just some person within radio range. But that's actually, you know, that's a relatively solvable problem. They need to be a little bit more promiscuous with your identity. It would surprise me if that doesn't happen intentionally or unintentionally, given the trajectory that mobile technology is going. We're already seeing things like the Google Locator service that's just, you know, kind of spewing out your location onto the web. You know, yeah, they claim it's private, but do you really believe them? The more interesting part of this looks at data filtration. You know, you've got this data shadow out there, but what does it mean? How do you map that into social space? There's this concept of the semantic web, which talks about, you know, imbuing meaning into data. There's social network enumeration. You know, we're dumping a massive amount of information online about who we are. You know, and if I can correlate your Facebook profile and your OkCupid profile and your FetLife profile and your Google Locate, I basically know everything that I need to know about you to some degree to know whether or not I want to go talk to you. And there's also heuristic analysis of past social interactions. You know, if as this kind of stuff starts to get more common, we can say, you know, oh, you really liked sleeping with so-and-so, and their profile matches up heuristically with this other person. You probably like sleeping with them, too. You know, if you liked Mary, you should try Susan. It's not clear, of course, what something like this would do to the public context. You know, there's this sort of standard of public propriety right now, which is why we don't bring up sex in the grocery store that much. But do we want to do that? I mean, you know, is that actually useful for society to have those kinds of walls? There are other implications of the system like this, which are kind of scary. Sexualizing public space is a very double-edged sword. You know, you have stalking, you have rape, you have rampant misogyny. What happens with all of those when privacy goes away? Is that something that we want to deal with? You know, possibly we should think about that before we let privacy go away. Visible identities. So fashion and body language are wonderful things. They can tell a lot about you, but only so much and only in certain ways. Fashion identity feed a lot of things, you know? Great, you wanna show the world that you've opted out as a consumer? Well, you know, there's a product line for that. You can go buy those. And they have real limits in terms of what they can show. You know, a complicated kind of fractured identity is not necessarily very visible. I mean, try walking down the street as a femme dyke. No one notices. You know, and that's a fairly straightforward case. Turning our bodies into physical billboards, you know, by t-shirts, by pins, by whatever, kind of only goes so far. And because that medium has social implications, there are only certain identities that you can present that way. You know, I mean, you get all sorts of class signs which are contradicted by that, you know, et cetera. And maybe you don't want to present those identities, whatever. But, you know, there's a limit to the kind of identity that you can project. So why bother trying to do it in physical space? Why try to make a complex identity fit into a commoditized physical world? Splash it around your virtual self. Replace the body that you see, that people see you with some mutable full-body avatar. Show the world an entirely different identity without any of those physical complications. Don't want to push things that far? How about a set of icons around you, some kind of iconographic graphics that show off different facets of your identity and surface different slices of that data cloud? For anyone who hasn't been watching it explode over the past few years, there's this concept called augmented reality, basically overlaying digital graphics on real-time video that are situated in three space. So, you know, you're holding up your phone and you're looking through it like a window, and, you know, I see all sorts of graphics floating over people, you know, or I'm wearing some kind of head mount display, and perhaps it's just replacing large parts of my visual field with virtual things. It's been exploding for a lot of reasons. I mean, there's kind of a technological convergence that's making it possible and making it cheap. You know, the iPhone as the AR device seems to be its kind of killer app right now for making it possible. There's a lot of challenges right now. Short-range object registration, you know, saying, okay, that's you, you know, align those things correctly. But a lot of those challenges are going away. You know, they're engineering challenges, not deeper problems. And as that matures, you know, at what point does it cease being, well, first a toy and then like, oh, great, I can, you know, see data about buildings. I can find the nearest Starbucks. I can find the nearest McDonald's. I can find, you know, the nearest anarchist bookstore. When does that become a social space? When can I say, oh, I'm gonna project parts of who I am into this thing? To a certain degree, that requires a kind of ubiquity. The same with the previous fiction. It doesn't really get interesting until you can just assume that I'm walking down the street, and certainly anyone who's interested will look at me virtually, you know, or maybe everyone is just going to see that at all times. On the other hand, all of this stuff is tied to relatively expensive products. I mean, there's already some concern in this very nascent AR movement that it's kind of creating this haves and have-nots. You know, the people who have iPhones are hooked into all of this stuff because a lot of it is single platform right now. It's this very immature technology. What happens to everybody else? You know, have you created this class division? What happens when 95% of your social identity is expressed not in physical space? So advertising, culturally, is it's a huge source of propagation of culture. Specifically, it's propagating the desires of culture. It's propagating, you know, it's saying, this is what you want, very explicitly. That changes how you think about who you are, whether or not you want it to. You know, you get onto the subway and you see all of those ads saying, oh, you're not a good enough person, your body isn't good enough, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to become better, you need to become socially acceptable. You know, you walk down, you know, you walk through a fashion district and you see billboards, you see advertisement. You know, even if you avoid media offline, even if you filter those other layers, you still end up receiving those messages because you interact with public space. And they change how you think about the relationships you can have. They think how you can think about the sex you can have, the kind of sexual person you can be. Being invisible in that advertising affects your identity, or being very visible, or being very desirable or undesirable. Several years ago in 2006, Sao Paulo decided to ban all outdoor advertising. Stores are restricted to a sign 1.5 meters wide by, I think, 1 meter tall, and that's it. That's the only outdoor advertising, excepting, you know, certain public cultural events in the entire city, which is wonderful. I've been meaning to go there to see what it's like to interact with a city with no advertising. But why wait for that to come to your city? You know, be a fairly intrusive AR application, but why not just block it all out? Recognize where those ads are and just overlay them, you know, ad block for reality. What would that do to how you think about your identity? What would that do to someone to be raised without ever seeing any of those images? Or certainly not like, oh yeah, that's funny, I'm gonna, you know, take off the glasses for a second, God, that's really ugly, I'll put them back on again. How does that affect your reality to never receive those images? How does that affect how you integrate with the rest of society and culture to never receive those images? On the other hand, this goes both ways. what happens when the spammers integrate themselves into augmented reality? You know, worse, what happens when the legitimate marketers integrate themselves into augmented reality? You know, you've got this potential escape. All of a sudden, it's just sort of another front. Making sex safe again. So the sexual revolution at the end of the modern period in the 60s and the 70s was brought about by a lot of things and enabled by a lot of things. The pill was one of the big enablers there because it divorced sex and reproduction. On the other hand, in the 80s and the 90s, HIV, the rise of at least the awareness of rape culture, all of these things kind of tried to push that back in the can. It was kind of the backlash. You know, you get this sort of late heteronormativity. How can we make sex less serious again? You know, can you roll that back? What if we could get rid of that seriousness, at least to some degree? Picture yourself out drinking at a bar. There's a woman there who you've got some definite chemistry with. You've just met, but you'd really like to get laid tonight, and neither of you remembered to bring gloves. So you both get out your phones. You might exchange numbers, but first you exchange a limited medical authorization. You tap your phone against her abdomen, and, you know, wait for a second, and yeah, okay, great. All the STI antibody checks came back green, you're fine. You know, she does the same thing, you walk out the door, great. Implantable medical devices are advancing by leaps and bounds today. Currently, most implantable devices are very special purpose devices focusing on therapeutic single functions. That's changing very rapidly though. Right now they're mostly being used for various kinds of electrical stimulation, pacemakers, et cetera. A lot of companies have been working on drug dispensing, on various other kinds of physiological sensing. You know, implant manufacturers are very conservative, both because of the FDA, because of lawsuits. You know, it's, at least right now, you know, as this technology matures, as we get more used to it, as the risks of implantation go down, I think we're going to see some change there. I think we're going to see a bit more creativity. People are already looking in the research phase at networks of multiple implants. So you've got an impedance sensor looking at lung fluid, and you've got something else that dispenses an emergency bronchodilator, and you've got something else logging all that data and then occasionally talking out to an external device. And you can put these devices in different places. You know, you can put the drug implant where it needs to be to get drugs into the system effectively. You can put the sensor where it needs to be. You can put the external radio somewhere where it's easy to recharge it. These devices are extremely power limited. That's starting to change. Some of the new devices can be recharged inductively. There's research being done on biofuel cells so that you can basically suck power from the body to power these devices like parasites. There are a lot of security concerns, which are really fascinating. I also do computer security work. And, you know, it's kind of horrifying. I mean, you know, these are things which can kill you. These are things that can change your physiological state. These are devices that do not have the CPU power to run modern cryptography. They have extremely little data storage. How do you create a secure connection to that, to the outside world? People are working on the problems, though, and, you know, Moore's Law has a way of kind of making those go away. Another interesting relevant technology is microfluidics, which is basically moving around very minute amounts of liquids on chip-scale devices. These are being used for, among other things, medical diagnostics. Disease detection is one of the big priorities there because it lets you automate and simplify detection processes that right now require, you know, a full-size medical lab into, you know, something really very small and fast and cheap. These are also built via semiconductor fabrication, and so they're also getting smaller and they're getting faster. They have some different limits, but size is not immediately going to be one of them. They also follow a similar cost trajectory. You know, when, you know, the first one costs $1 billion and the billionth one costs $1. As we understand these implants better and the risk of implantation surgery drops, I think we're going to see more diagnostic, you know, purely diagnostic devices come on the market. One recently just in, I think it was 2007, didn't get FDA approval, but they're going back, they're trying again. eventually, I think we'll see, you know, a just sort of general purpose medical implant being a perfectly reasonable preventative care device that you just sort of get implanted when you're fairly young. And, you know, it looks, you know, make sure that you don't have any odd diseases, just keeps a record of your physiological stats. You don't have to worry about going in and getting a physical once a year necessarily, because that data is just getting piped up continuously. And somebody, you know, something's looking at it, something will let someone know if you need to come in and have, you know, some more work done or whatever. Devices like this, because they're in the body, because they're continuously monitoring the bloodstream, may be able to do disease detection much more quickly, both because as soon as something becomes detectable in the bloodstream, they'll see it, and also because they're, you know, they're continuously retesting, so they should be able to operate with much lower antibody levels than, you know, a lot of the current external tests can. As these systems get built, you know, we will end up with a flexible authentication and authorization system, because if nothing else, you have emergency care where an EMT has to be able to override this system right now, and they can't necessarily wait to contact a doctor and do this heavyweight process. So that's going to have to be solved. We have, you know, child care, we have elder care. You're going to have to be able to delegate control of these devices as well. If you can do all of that, why not delegate it for social reasons? Why not say, oh yeah, I'm going to give you this small piece of authorization, you know, and you can check these things, and you can then get some verifiable record that, oh yeah, they're clean. We don't have to worry about all these things. You know, let's kind of roll back that seriousness. On the other hand, what happens when someone reprograms their implant to lie? You know, clearly there's a crime there, but what's the crime? Is the crime that they lied about their STI status, or is the crime that they reprogrammed that medical device? Are medical devices part of your body? Are they part of you in a legal sense? Let's say there's a date rape trial and the accused would like to prove that, oh yeah, you weren't intoxicated, you consented. Can your implant be forced to testify against you? You know, does it have Fifth Amendment rights? Is it an external computing device, or is it part of you? This next one is something which is actually possible today. There is a spot on the sacral nerve where you can basically induce an orgasm if you poke a couple of electrodes at it. Poking electrodes at things is something that medical implants do very well right now. It's actually kind of the thing that they do very well. There's a researcher in, I believe, North Carolina, who has done clinical tests on a device that basically, you know, you push a button, you have an orgasm, and had, I think, a 95% success rate for previously aorgasmic women. What does that do to sex? You know, all of a sudden, sex isn't necessarily, you know, orgasm isn't necessarily connected to sex at all. You know, is this the ultimate sex toy that, you know, you push the button, you get the orgasm, you know, that very kind of orgasm-centric masculine view of sex? On the other hand, what happens if you're just like, oh, you know, as Annalie was saying the other night, you know, what happens when you're sitting in a class? It's just like, oh yeah, I really like this material. I think I'll give myself an orgasm right now. Does that change how you associate that material? On the other hand, you know, there are a lot of fetishes built up around orgasms. What happens when you give that button to someone else and it's, you know, speaking over the cell network, and all of a sudden you don't have control over your orgasms at all? If you can induce an orgasm, you can sense an orgasm. You know, you just watch the levels on those nerves. If you can sense an orgasm, you can suppress an orgasm. You just apply an inverted electrical charge and the nerves don't fire. You know, so this is both, it's not just induction, it's control, it's sensing. Monitoring is really interesting. So on one level, this could be the ultimate purity ring. You know, want to absolutely know that your wife never had an orgasm before you got married? Here you go. You know, she was implanted before puberty, you know, and you don't even have to learn how to be good at sex. You can just push the button, you know, all that control. On the other hand, the interaction with things like sex offense is interesting. That's very complicated territory, but, you know, and I'm not going to say that sex offenders are offending because they're trying to get off only. It's obviously much, much more complicated than that. But on the other hand, you know, say somebody's got an anklet bracelet for tracking their location, And they also now have to account for every orgasm that they had as a condition of their parole. Like, you know, what were you doing? They talk to their therapist, like, you know, what were you thinking about when you had this orgasm? Can that be a useful form of treatment? Is it just social control? What, you know, what happens there? How would this change sex work? You know, all of a sudden, the orgasm and achieving the orgasm, it doesn't necessarily have to be the focus of the interaction. You know, is it going to be that it becomes more about human contact? Is it going to be, you know, do you end up with new classes of sex worker? Like, you know, I will titillate you within the bounds of the law and then press the button. You know, how does that work? Speaking of sex work, sex workers right now, if they're performing heteronormative acts, are at a legal disadvantage to their clients in most legal regimes. It's complicated, conflicted political territory in the modern left, but you know, that much is relatively certain. In order for a sex worker to operate, their clients have to be able to find them in some context. But those clients may be relatively anonymous. That imbalance of identification when combined with the legal structures means there's a real power dynamic there. The sex worker is also frequently legally vulnerable, where in a lot of states, in a lot of contexts, the client is only socially vulnerable at best. So imagine you're a sex worker and your most recent session went poorly and the client didn't pay. But they can't avoid leaving DNA material behind. So you take a swab of that and you drop it into a paperback book-sized sequencer, and 10 minutes later you've got a genome sequence, and you upload it and search it against a public database. You find an identity match. The sequencer signs that genome sequence when it did it with a cryptographic signature. It's anonymous, so they can't trace it back to which sequencer did it, but it does verify that, yes, this was an untampered sequencer. You know, this is a valid result, at least from the material that was put into it. We're finding out that, yeah, DNA evidence can be forged, but why did someone want to forge that? You know, so you upload that with a note attached anonymously about, you know, these are the circumstances under which this was taken, and just kind of let Google do the rest. You know, that note gets attached to their data cloud. The people in their relationship see it. You know, I mean, should that be something that has social consequences? That's another question. Right now it does, though. And what does that do to that power imbalance? Outsourcing judgment. So people do a lot of stupid stuff when they're drunk and they're high, and a lot of it involves sex. Sometimes your friends are around to step in, but a lot of the time they're not. Can you protect someone from themselves? Take a pair of glasses with a camera in them, some kind of display, a speakerphone, an implant that measures blood alcohol level or other intoxicants. Before you go out drinking, you set the limits on how intoxicated you want to get, what kind of behavior you want to, you know, engage in. Later that night, you go out to a bar. You walk up to get another drink. An icon flashes in your glasses, and it's like, oh, well, I'm cut off. Bartender sees it. You know, you've decided, you know, previously that's enough. You're somewhere else. You're flirting with someone. A voice in your ear warns you that, no, you're not sober enough to consent. You know, you decided previously that you didn't want to do this. You ignore it. A little bit longer, and your phone trips over into speakerphone mode and informs the other person that you are too drunk to consent and that you are legally no longer in charge of your actions, and specifically that the person on the other end of that video and voice link is, and they're saying no for you, and that this is legally binding. You go home. You have less of a headache. You have fewer complications in the morning. Portable streaming video and micro displays are common technology. Getting them into a socially acceptable package is still difficult. But, you know, that's something that people have been working on for a long time. And it may end up changing with other devices that we're carrying anyway or interacting with anyway. The legal implications here are kind of interesting, though. Can you programmatically give away your legal right to make decisions, you know, on some timer, on some schedule? You know, how does that work? What would it be like to be working in a call center for outsourced judgment? You know, obviously this isn't going to stop sexual assault, but on the other hand, it can kind of provide a sort of buddy system. You know, it gives you some degree of control even when you've decided through your actions to give it up. How little bandwidth do you need to support an intimate relationship? Long distance relationships are really hard. One of the things that's really hard about them is this kind of daily awareness, the ongoing feeling of connection that you get from a local lover, even if, you know, well, yeah, you see each other a few times a week, but there's still that kind of ambient feeling of like, oh yeah, we're in each other's lives. You know, when you see each other every few months for a week, that gets a lot more difficult to maintain. You know, we've got Skype, we've got IM, we've got SMS, we've got flat rate phone plans. It's made it a lot easier. What else can we do? There are a lot of things that express the daily rhythm of life. What if you shared a heartbeat with a lover? You each wear a bracelet, you have an EKG. It transmits your pulse to them and theirs to yours. There's a little actuator on your wrist and you just feel their pulse continuously. It would get really annoying for a while. But something that's been found out with other devices like this is that eventually you get a kind of sensory integration. Quinn Norton and a few other people I know have been playing with various kinds of direction indicating body worn prostheses that have, you know, like vibrating motors that always point north or always point at some object or, you know, variations on those. And eventually you don't register it as, oh, that's the way the motor is buzzing and that's north. It's just, and you don't even register that the motor is buzzing. You just register that's north. Something like this eventually would probably get that same kind of sensory integration. And it would be the, oh yeah, I think they just woke up. You know, their heartbeat's moving faster a bit. Oh, they must have been running for the subway, whatever. You know, what does that rhythm of life, you know, what does that kind of thing do? Some studies in the 80s showed that loud music can end up synchronizing, you know, that kind of significant external stimulus can end up synchronizing your heartbeat with the beat of the music. Would your heart rates end up synchronizing through this data channel over time? You know, would you find it's like, wow, they're already asleep. It's really hard to keep moving. You know, would they not be able to go to sleep until you did? What happens when you have two or three partners and you're synchronizing with all of them and you're getting multiple heartbeats in? So a heartbeat is a pretty simple measure of physiological state. What about the endocrine system? We're starting to understand just how much of how we feel and how we think and how we perceive things are dependent on a fairly small number of brain chemicals. These are really complex systems. We don't want to tamper with these too much, but on the other hand, we already kind of are. You know, that's what all of the SSRIs, that's what all of this stuff is. They act at best on a 4-hour time scale. They're not short term. What happens when we have immediate procedural control over our neurochemistry? This has, you know, really interesting therapeutic effects, but it also allows us to introduce time-based behaviors as a form of endocrine management or neurotransmitter management. Imagine an endocrine or neurotransmitter mirror so that you are chemically mirroring the affective state of your partner at all times. You know, yeah, you probably need some feedback filters. You don't want that going haywire. You know, you may want to say, okay, both of us are going to get kind of tugged in some certain directions that we've found help stabilize our interactions, you know, that give the mood feeling that we want. This could trigger all sorts of new codependency, like entirely new levels. But it could also radically change those interactions. You know, it could make you more compatible. It could be the, oh, gee, we don't really argue anymore. We can resolve things differently because we have this kind of, you know, higher level of emotional attunement. You know, what happens when that's broadcast over long distances? It's like the, gee, I'm feeling really bummed out. She must be having a bad day. Even if it's not networked with someone else, you can still induce behavior like, you know, oh, every time so-and-so walks into the room, I want to get an oxytocin bump, you know, have that honeymoon phase of a relationship last forever. You know, and you can do all sorts of things, you know, any stimulus that you can measure, you know, oh, I want to feel elated when the stock market goes up. I want to feel scared when it goes down. you know, and so your mood mirrors the stock market. Virtual productions of identity are great, but what about the body itself? There's a huge catalog of ways that people have altered themselves for a long time, but excepting maybe hair and makeup and fashion, it's all really slow, and even that is slow on a social scale. You know, it may change day to day, but it doesn't change minute to minute. Can we physically project identities that are situational? There are a lot of interesting reasons to do this and not just monocultural acceptance. The kinds of fractured social spaces that we have kind of lead to this, like, oh, I'm going into this social space. I'd like to be someone else right now. I'd like to surface this other part of me. So you wake up in the morning and you go about your usual routine. You toss on a pair of jeans and a t-shirt and you head for the train. On the train, you pull out your phone and you dial in, I think my pants should be black today and green t-shirt. You poke around online, you find a cute animation, you grab a frame from it, you toss it on your t-shirt. Nothing too flashy, it's just the morning, you know. You get into work and the tattoos in your right arm kind of fade in. It's a relaxing day, it's kind of moving slowly. Your skin changes through the day, you know, blank canvas when you're talking to a client who's kind of older and a bit more conservative, kind of darker, more aggressive stuff when you're biking across town. You're in the evening, you're at the club, your shirt is cycling some vaguely biomechanical animation, your ex walks by and your skin kind of flashes black and you're like, you know, this sort of shock, and you kind of slip out the back. Products are already showing up on the market with flexible, low resolution, liquid crystal based wraps that change color. There's a cell phone that you can buy now that you can set the color of the phone. It's not glowing. It's nothing like that. It's the whole phone that you can just change the color. E-ink displays are getting better. They're getting cheaper. We're going to see color. We're going to see faster update speeds. Changing form for clothing is a little bit more difficult, but there are already color-changing textiles. They're still experimental, but they're not going to be for that long. You could build implantable versions of these displays too, but there are a lot of other possibilities there. This is kind of the one exception to the bioengineering stuff. What happens if you get a skin graft that has genes integrated from cephalopod chromatophores and, you know, you can change your skin color biologically? And maybe it's controlled by an implant. Maybe you're not directly actuating that, you know, because there isn't that pathway of actuation, you know, which is one thing. So maybe that's how your tattoos are fading in and out. On the other hand, what if that gets turned into an effective response, either to something that's kind of sensing your emotional state, or we do figure out how to hook up that linkage? You know, what happens if we suddenly add this kind of new channel for emotional interaction? You know, all of a sudden we've got body language and we've got skin tone, you know, and it's like you start breaking out into sexy spots, or, you know, you kind of match your background and try and, you know, blend into the couch. So profound body modification is something that's been a fantasy for a whole lot of people for a really long time. It's also really, really hard. Medical technology isn't really likely to get there for a long time based on current trajectories. Some of the implants I'm talking about are invasive. This is kind of way off the scale. But there's a lot of people who would be really interested in that sort of thing. And there are other possibilities. Biomechanical hybrids are a lot more achievable. Would you give up a right arm to have a prosthetic tentacle in its place that could sense pressure and temperature? There are a few really interesting emerging technologies here. There's functional electrical stimulation, which is a specific type of electrical stimulation that's being used in a bunch of different ways. Basically, they've got little boxes that allow a paraplegic patient to stand because they're just using the box to drive the nerves for the leg muscles directly and replacing that gap in the spinal column, or that allow quadriplegics to have grasp function. There's research also being done using the same techniques to drive information into sensory nerves to give us a prosthetic arm that can sense pressure, that can sense temperature, there's a phenomenon called neuroplasticity, where the brain reconstructs and modifies how it interprets signals. Stroke recovery is a function of neuroplasticity, where different parts of the brain will take over previous functions. Chronic recovery is implicated with neuroplasticity, where a nerve gets used to sending pain signals and it just keeps sending them, and the brain just starts to expect those pain signals. So even if they stop, it keeps reading them. It's also important for modern prosthetics. There are these implanted electrode grids that are used for receiving and driving FES signals. They're also being used for automatically driving arms, where you just read the signal out and then you turn it into a motor sense. Initially, the nerves just kind of send and receive noise, but with training, you can learn to alter your brain so that you actually get those functional behaviors. It's easier for a prosthetic arm if you use the nerves in the stump, but you don't have to. You can connect them into a patch on the chest. You could add another arm that connects to those nerves there and eventually train that to move as well. This is kind of on the cutting edge of what's possible with today's technology. It's not anything in current deployment. There are a lot of challenges. The cutting edge for FES is like a dozen connections, not 10,000 connections in a grid. You have to make each one of those manually with very time-intensive microsurgery. Penetrating the skin is really difficult for prosthetics. For the electrical connections for FES, you don't need to. You can have a radio link, that's fine. Structural connections are another problem, though. If you want to have a really solid arm that's comfortable to wear for long periods of time, you'd really like it to be anchored to bone. There's work being done there on using gum tissue, because gums do that. They bridge something hard out of the body. You know, grafting to bone is a relatively, not solved, but understood problem. You know, and it's possible that by using a combination of existing grafting technology and cultured gum tissue, we could provide, you know, a hard point on your arm so you can screw a prosthesis into that and have a really firm connection there. This is all aimed at traditional therapeutic implants. Attitudes around prosthetics are a fascinating microcosm of how society treats disability and medicine in general. Research is almost always aimed at bringing the disabled person back to some kind of social norm, but that's not how technology works. Once you get the basic integration with human form working, you can do anything you want. Amy Mullins, who's a double leg amputee, gave a fascinating TED talk recently, and she recounts a story in there about, you know, she has about a dozen different pairs of legs, and she has one pair that adds 5 inches to her height. And she wore those to a cocktail party for the first time, and her friend saw her and was like, "Oh, you're so tall." And she was like, "Yeah, isn't this great? But that's not fair." People get really weirded out when it's all of a sudden, "Oh, you can do something that I can't. You're not really disabled anymore. You're not supposed to do that. You're breaking that cultural script." And those aren't even powered prosthetics. You know, the structural requirements for legs are a lot more rigorous. There's only so many things that you can do to legs that will still enable even a vaguely normal gait, that will still enable you to get around. With arms, you can do all sorts of things, though. There's another emerging area of research called soft body robotics, which is basically things that move like slugs. There's a DARPA surveillance drone research project that's basically something that moves like an earthworm, and it can squeeze under doors, and it can squeeze through narrow pipes because it just kind of moves like this blobby thing. Fabricating soft body robots is hard, but there's a lot of promise in 3D printing techniques, especially multi-material 3D printing techniques. Combining these technologies, it wouldn't be that difficult in, you know, 15 years to have a tentacle which is functional, which has grasp strength, which has pressure and temperature sensation that you get feedback from. How are people going to react the first time they see someone walking down the street with a tentacle for an arm? How are they going to react the first time they pick someone up in a bar with a tentacle for an arm? So fuck buddies are great. Everyone should have at least a half dozen. Scheduling really sucks, though. You decide you'd like to get laid tonight. You don't really have anyone specific in mind. So you send out an SMS to the emergency booty call network. It goes through your A-list. Nobody takes you up on it. It goes through your B list and your C list. You've told the system that you'd like dinner beforehand. So it looks at the preferences that other people have set, you know, looks at their calendars, says, oh yeah, you should meet so-and-so here. You know, if you need a reservation there, it sends the reservation request in. Say, you know, everyone you already know is busy. System asks you, well, do you want to throw out a wider net? Yeah, sure. You want a surprise. You tell the system to just set up a date. It tells you to be at some location and you'll meet someone there. You've already told it what you're looking for in general and tonight. The people you've slept with have vouched for you as a distributed reputation system. And other people have decided how much they trust those people's opinions. So when a stranger sees your request, they have a measure of what the community thinks of you and how distant you are socially. This one and the next one are a little bit less design related than some of the other stuff. Heterosexual sex and reproduction have already been separated. Pregnancies are really complicated. That's kind of in the same, you know, like external pregnancy is kind of in the same arena as, you know, biological massive body modification. It's not coming that soon. But genetic manipulations have already let us create embryos that have two mothers and no father, three fathers and a mother. That's a pretty good starting point towards having a non-traditional but actually reproductive family unit. One of the other interesting things is breastfeeding. In modern Western society, that's just the birth mother. You know, there's a tradition of wet nurses, but lactation isn't that hard to induce. You can induce it in basically anyone. There's a lot of benefits there. There's a, you know, kind of a hormonal emotional bond. There's shared immunity to disease. What does it do to a non-traditional family unit if both fathers and the mother are all breastfeeding? You know, that changes the economics of breastfeeding. It means that, oh yeah, everybody can still work because, you know, you don't have, you know, I mean, they may have to shift their schedules around a bit, but it's not like, oh yeah, mom has to stay home or you have to deal with pumping because, you know, there has to be someone around to feed the baby. You know, and this is something that's limited even in existing heteronormative families because the father is completely excluded from that relationship. You know, it's also something that gets kind of leveled at non-traditional families. This is like, oh yeah, you know, she's the real parent. You're not actually parents. You know, you're just sort of, you don't really have any natural connection there. So that's kind of something you can throw in the face of that. You know, that plus genetics, what else do you want? On the other hand, you know, if you have a father breastfeeding, that kind of changes how you construct masculinity. It doesn't sound like a bad thing. Gay marriage is fine. It's great. Congratulations. The heteronormative relationship contract has been extended by one small notch. Why not blow it out of the water instead? In the 1886 decision, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, corporations were granted natural rights as person with basically no legal precedent. Throughout their history, corporations have been these fascinatingly flexible legal constructions. Why not use those same techniques and construct corporate entities which are personal relationships? You know, enforcing that kind of contract is going to be challenging. You know, that's going to be a long road. But if you don't create the contracts, you know, nobody's going to kind of know where to start. You know, set up this modular system that's like, oh, okay, you want to give these rights to this partner and these rights to this partner. You want to share property in these specific ways. You know, we've got Creative Commons. You know, why not creative relationships? The economic structures of heteronormative relationships are really reinforce those relationships in the culture to kind of an amazing degree. If we want to break those relationship patterns, we have to break the economic patterns that support them and create them and really enforce them. Divorcing economic structures from reproduction is great, you know, and that's just as fundamental of a change as divorcing sex from reproduction. This is a hugely complex problem. There's, you know, most of it has to do with social norms and, you know, literal economics than design. But one exception to that is the built environment. Those relationships are programmed into and enforced by the environment that we live in and by the houses that we live in. Raising children is hard. Some form of income sharing and labor sharing is really hard to do without. It strains the resources of a lot of couples. The dominance of the intimate couple as the core family unit is reflected in housing. if you want to construct an alternate sharing arrangement for that economic power that isn't based around an intimate couple, you have to literally fight that that embedding in housing. You know, that arrangement literally doesn't fit in the built environment. Picture a group of 3 to 5 people, all either raising their own children or committed to help raise the children of other people in the group. None of them are involved with each other. There are no intimate relationships in that subgroup. They have outside partners. They have, you know, serious long-term outside partners who may be involved in those, in that child rearing, but they're not part of that family. You know, the family unit is this non-relationship intimate unit. You know, where do they live? One model would be a cluster of small apartments. You know, each one has a bedroom for the parent and the kids, a separate bathroom, a small private living area. And then they all share a common kitchen and common larger living space. Trying to shoehorn that relationship structure into a set of more traditional apartments can work, but it's really difficult, and it's really difficult to maintain it and keep it there without some kind of support. You know, how often do you find 4 one-bedroom apartments next to each other in an apartment building all for rent at the same time? If the group can afford to have custom construction work done, that's great, but it may not actually be possible. Housing codes frequently prevent that kind of thing. Banks won't lend you money because they're like, oh, this isn't a good risk for us. We can't resell this. It's too weird. And that's if you have the money to do custom construction. If you're economically disadvantaged, forget it. You know, and you're going to have less flexibility in the other kinds of housing that are available. There's kind of no reason for the monoculture of housing that we have. There's no reason for it not to be broader. Until we get variety into the available housing stock, we're going to be stuck with these at least strongly pair-based, you know, heteronormative and heteronormative recreating power structures. And that's it. Kind of thrown. I've thrown a whole bunch of stuff out there. Hopefully some of this will give you new ways to look at, you know, what you do, how you construct your lives, how you construct your relationships. And remember, sleep with your local designer. The future of sex depends on it. If anyone's got any questions.
Yeah, of course. I think we have time for like 2 or 3 questions. So, yeah, the problem is the microphone cable is not long enough. So please ask your question and you please repeat it so we have it on the recording of the MP3 file.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So the question was about kind of the fetishization of disabled people and augmentation and prosthetics. So one of the things which I think is, I mean, I think it is interesting, the concept of, you know, creating more ability, but it's also like, okay, at what point is it the, yes, this affects disabled people, but this is something that I want to do. Like, I would rather cut off my arm and replace it with a tentacle because that's more useful. Because that, you know, this is no longer a disability. This is something that increases my flexibility. I think there's a lot of other territory that can be covered in terms of, you know, these are not things which are applicable only to disability. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know, the existing medical establishment is already kind of working to kind of bring things up to normal, and that's sort of that construction. I think people's perceptions of what that means are slowly starting to change, but I think it's going to be a long time before we get meaningful change there in terms of how people perceive disability? So the question was how your ability with like an augmented reality system or kind of in general to choose what you see and what you don't see socially, how that changes society, how that fragments it. Are we creating tunnel vision? I think in a lot of ways we are. You know, I think that's one of the things that comes with those fragmented identities is that, you know, there is this slice of San Francisco that I see. And, you know, that's already true. I mean, I come to San Francisco, I see very specific parts of it, and I don't see the other parts of it. I may interact with them, but you don't see them in a meaningful way. And I think that's going to continue to be a big problem. I think that is something that we are going to have to address as a culture. I don't think that's something that technology is going to particularly help us with. I think technology is going to make it much easier to ignore people. And to ignore content and to ignore whole sectors of society. It's very good at that already. The question was if I have an opinion on how modular housing might affect social structures. I think in terms of more flexibility, it's obviously a really good thing. I'm not sure if it's a good thing for housing, but it's probably a good thing for the flexibility of housing. You know, if I can reconstruct the set of modules that make up this living space easily, if that ends up actually being accessible to the end user, that's obviously going to give us more flexibility. On the other hand, a lot of those systems end up not really being deployed in that way. It ends up being, oh, this is going to save the person who builds the property money, but it's not necessarily going to give the people who live there more flexibility. And a lot of those modules end up embedding a lot of those same decisions. They don't necessarily have to, but you know, if the module company won't sell you 4 bedrooms and no kitchen, well, you know, there is possibility there, but it's not necessarily going to save us.
Okay. So, thanks a lot, Ella. Thank you. Okay. So, there's so many people here who are actually tweeting, and it's actually good. There's almost like a tweet battle going on. And there's just, because I know you, who you are and stuff. So first of all, this really charming person here referred me as the speaker, and that's not correct. That's impolite. I am the head of conference, not a speaker, okay? I'm European, I'm Austrian. I insist on my title, okay? So good. So, in fact, I think many people might not know me. My name is Johannes. I'm part of Monochrome. We are the organizers of Ars Electronica. And over there is Christoph, who is our co-organizer at Blowfish, the local wonderful... What is it actually? Like a sex shop? No. It's like a sex shop experience. Let's call it this way. It sounds better. Okay, a sex toy company. Perfect. Yeah, okay. Good. Please don't forget to tweet, you know, first they tweet and later they shit on your head. That's what's happening. Okay. So, I have to stop the recording of the first talk now, but in like 2 or 3 minutes, we will have our next very special guest star, Are You Serious? So just like 2 minutes of break, and then we'll go on with the next talk.